your nonprofit forward? You've come to the right place. Welcome to the Nonprofit Architect, where we are giving you the actionable steps you need to launch and grow your nonprofit organization. Now, here's your host, Travis Johnson.
Hey, welcome to this morning. I'm here today with Alan Stein Jr. Alan, how are you doing today?
Oh, I'm fantastic, Travis. It's so nice to connect with you.
Absolutely. I know we had some back and forth on email and you weren't sure like why on earth would I hop on the show with a nonprofit and it's not what I do. What made you decide to make the leap?
Well, you know, my number one reason for going on anyone's podcast or speaking at anyone's event is to add value to their lives. And I always want to make sure that there's a nice alignment between what I have to share and what the audience will find valuable. And I'm so thankful that you persisted and that you really clarified kind of the guardrails of this conversation and feel great about the stuff that I can share, you know, to offer value to the nonprofit world. Because yes, after the initial email, I wasn't sure. So I really and truly appreciate, again, your persistence and your clarification. And we'll have a really, really good convo.
I tell you, and our nonprofit leaders listening to this, you understood what he just said, right? He understood that he wasn't really on board at our initial meeting. And when you look at conversations with a donor or trying to cultivate a relationship, they might not understand where you're coming from right away. But if you take the time to go back and clarify and really connect, then you're going to have breakthroughs. Like I do with all my guests, I bought Alan's book, Raise Your Game, High Performance Secrets from the Best of the Best. Those of you who've been listening to me for a while, you know that in 2019, I read 60 books and I've just been crushing it like nobody's business. And it's about 270-ish pages, which I would normally read in the afternoon. I spent all weekend on this stinking thing and I couldn't get through it because I'm taking notes on literally every stupid page and I'm saying bad things because I'm so annoyed that I didn't just breeze through this, but I'm not because there's so much value in this and what it is that you do. For the people that don't know who you are and what you do, Alan, can you give us a little rundown of what you are and what you do?
Well, I would imagine that's the vast majority of people don't know who I am or what I do. So no, gladly. As it pertains to this conversation, I'm a former basketball performance coach, and I spent close to 20 years working with some of the highest performing basketball players in the world. And I'm really thankful that I have a unique journey, and my journey was unique because I got a chance to work with some elite level players, guys like Kevin Durant and Victor Oladipo, back when they were teenagers. So I got to see the before picture, if you will, you know, when they were 14, 15 years old, and the mindsets and habits and routines that it took for them to climb that mountain and reach the mountaintop. But then because of my work at two high schools here in the Washington, D.C. area, it led to some contract work with Nike basketball, Jordan Brand, USA basketball. So then I got a chance to work some events for players that had already reached the mountaintop. The after picture, if you will, LeBron James, Stephen Curry, the late, great Kobe Bryant. And I got to see the mindsets and rituals and routines that they did on a daily basis to not only stay on top of that mountaintop, but to continue to elevate as well. So I've been able to see both the before and the after picture of what it takes to be an elite level basketball player. And I now translate those messages to folks in other areas of the world and business. And now, certainly for those in the nonprofit world. And my goal today, you know, through our conversation, is to be able to provide some practical, actionable strategies on how folks can use the mindset of an elite basketball player and apply it to their mindset for being an elite leader in the nonprofit sector.
That's fantastic. For a little bit of context here, because I'm going to talk about basketball a little bit. I grew up in northern Minnesota, and I am 5'8". I'm wide. I'm designed to lift heavy objects. I'm awful at all things basketball. I'm no good. In fact, if you want to have me come out and join the basketball game, you would make sure I'm on the other team so you can just ensure your victory later that day. But, you know, I'm in Oklahoma City right now. I'm stationed here. I'm still active duty Navy. And so I was here when Chris Paul and the Hornets came to town, and then still here when Kevin Durant and Russell Westbrook and James Harden were cutting it up on the court, doing great things for the Thunder. Now have all moved on to other things. But if you don't take a look behind the curtain and see the rest of the iceberg and see what they're doing behind the scenes, you don't really know what it takes to become this elite level performer, I just got done reading the section where you got to watch Kobe Bryant start his practice at 4 a.m. and you showed up early, but you were still late. Tell us about that.
Oh, without question. You just hit an important nerve there. And that is, you know, regardless of what industry you're in, regardless of what it is that you aim for excellence in, a vast majority of your potential success lies in what you do during the unseen hours. To a basketball player, the unseen hours, you know, are when the cameras aren't rolling and the cheerleaders aren't dancing. It's when you are in a gym by yourself working on your craft. And it's the same in any area of life. And that's one of the reasons I'm so passionate about my work is these principles absolutely apply to every area of life. I mean, whether we're talking about a for-profit business, a nonprofit business, or even just talking about parenting, these principles still apply. And, you know, one of the first steps to becoming the performer that you're capable of becoming is learning how to master those unseen hours and make sure that when no one is watching, you still hold yourself to an incredibly high standard and you still work with purpose and intention on the skill sets that you need to be good at what you do. And you know, you referenced the late great Kobe Bryant. You know, that early morning in the gym, he was working on some very basic footwork and some very basic offensive moves. I mean, to the tune of he was doing drills that I had done with middle school age players. Now, certainly one of the things that separates Kobe Bryant from the rest of the world, he was doing so at an unparalleled level of intensity and with unquestionable focus and just, you know, surgical precision. I mean, he was working on the basics and the fundamentals, but he was doing so at an incredibly high level. And, you know, that actually surprised me as a young coach, because here Kobe Bryant at that time, this was in 2007. I mean, he was the best player in the world. And I was expecting him to be doing some really flashy and sexy drills, you know, something with a little more sizzle to it. And when I asked him later that day why a player of his stature would do such basic drills, he basically said that was the secret, which of course I'm saying in air quotes, the secret to his success was that he never gets bored with the basics. And when you kind of piece those together, those thoughts of, you know, focusing on the fundamentals and the basics, especially during the unseen hours when no one is watching, and understanding that repetition is not punishment. Repetition is the oldest and most effective form of learning and skill acquisition on the planet, and that's never going to change. When you kind of combine all of those things, we really shouldn't be surprised that Kobe was the elite level player he was. He understood the recipe and the blueprint for being really, really great. And in a game like basketball, the fundamentals are footwork and shooting mechanics and how you handle the ball. So to anyone listening to this right now in a leadership position, you need to ask yourself, what are the fundamentals of being an exceptional leader? You know, what are the fundamentals of being able to be influential and impactful? And ask yourself what those basics are, and then make sure you are working on those things relentlessly during the unseen hours. And that's what all of us should be doing if we really and truly want to be significant in our work.
I 100% agree. I've got more than 20 years in the military, and the unseen things that, you know, the public doesn't see is the hours upon hours upon hours of spent studying and training. That's right. For those of you that are not in the military, we spend hours upon hours studying, whether it's weaponry, tactics. I'm a mission commander on a nuclear command and control platform. I go through and I read through those rules of how to handle nuclear war. God forbid I ever use those skills. But just like the unseen hours of Kobe Bryant, and I'm not comparing myself to his level there, you know, you don't see those hours that go into this. If you're in the nonprofit world, you don't see the hours spent going over donor records and writing handwritten letters and doing all those great things that separate nonprofits that aren't funded to nonprofits that get every new project and every old project continually funded and growth year after year. What would you tell, Alan, what would you tell people that are unsure what it is that they're doing, and how do they like really define what their basics are that they need to reach their level of greatness?
Well, right before I go to that, I do want to touch on what you just said, because there was so much insight there. And first and foremost, as a civilian, I want to thank you for your service and all of your colleagues. And I have so much admiration for the armed forces for a variety of reasons. You know, courage and selflessness is at the top of that list. But as an overarching mindset, everyone that I've ever met that comes from a military background understands and appreciates the value of the basics. I think that is one of the things the United States Armed Forces does really, really well, is focus on fundamentals and work towards mastery of the basics to make sure that they are prepared for every situation. And that is absolutely something that should be applied. And of course, you know, when it comes to the military, we hope that most of your work is done during the unseen hours. Because in the military, when it's game time, that means there's going to be some type of you know, confrontation or war or some type of deployment. So we're actually all rooting for you all to spend most of your time in the unseen hours. But another quote comes to mind, and then I promise I will answer your question, that has to do directly with preparation in the unseen hours and certainly speaks volumes to your work in the military. And that is, it's always better to prepare for an opportunity that never arises than be unprepared for one that does. And, you know, that's kind of been one of my guiding mantras during this pandemic, which, you know, of course, at the time of this recording, we're getting close to being 1 year into a global pandemic. And, you know, I'm trying to do everything in my power as a professional keynote speaker and as an author and as a performance coach to make sure that when the world does open back up and we get back to having some of the freedoms that we were used to having before, as far as travel and large gatherings, I want to make sure that I am fully prepared for any opportunity that could come my way. And in order to do that, I have to be spending time during the unseen hours preparing for those. So I think that's a message that, once again, has such high utility and applies to everyone in any area of life. Now, back to your question, and this is why I'm so thankful that you persisted in saying, Alan, no, your message will work in the nonprofit sector. And that's because, for the most part, a leader is a leader is a leader. It doesn't matter if you're talking about the leader of a sports team, the leader of a Fortune 500 for-profit business, the leader of a nonprofit, or even the leader of your family, the leader of your church, a leader in a community organization. You know, leadership is about being able to develop other people. It's about pouring into others and caring about others and getting them to be able to accomplish things they most likely would not have been able to do without your leadership and your empowerment and so forth. It's about being able to have a positive impact and influence over other people. You know, that's kind of a collage of what leadership is. And that knows no boundaries, you know. So someone that is an amazing and immeasurable leader in the nonprofit world, they can and should be applying those leadership skills to any other area of their life. So when it comes to leadership, I think it's really important that someone sits down and asks themselves, you know, what type of leader would I like to be led by? And really get the, I always would ask that of coaches, you know, are you the type of coach that you'd want to play for? Are you the type of teammate you'd want to play with? And these questions are really, really important. And, you know, if I'm the leader of a nonprofit and I'm sitting there thinking, all right, what type of leader would I want to work for? And come up with a list of traits that I believe the most effective and influential leaders have, then I would start writing down those traits. And you're going to start to etch out a practice plan, if you will, of what the basics and the fundamentals are. You know, if you're listening to this and you think leaders should be A, B, and C, then the next question is, how well are you doing A, B, and C? And what are the basics and the fundamental building blocks of being good at A, B, and C? And make sure you're working on those. I'll give you one example, and then, you know, listeners can certainly decide for themselves. I believe that in any area of life, one of the most important characteristics for a leader to have is they need to care. They need to care about the people they're leading. They need to care about their organization. They need to care about the mission and the vision and the purpose of the organization. And my guess is that sense of purpose should be incredibly high in the nonprofit space in particular, because of just the general altruism of being in the nonprofit space. So then the next question would be, if caring is an important trait of a leader, then what's a fundamental that you can work on to show folks that you care? I'm a big believer as well that the most important gift we have to offer another human being is our attention in the present moment. And I believe you show someone that you care about them by giving them your attention in the present moment, something you're doing brilliantly right now, which is just actively listening. just being present, fully focused, you know, be where your feet are. So you're not distracted by anything else. And you're showing that other person through your eye contact, your body language, your facial expressions, your ability to ask insightful questions. You are showing them unconsciously, I care about you. You are important to me. I value what you have to say so much so that I'm willing to invest my most valuable currency, which is my time with you right now. So if we kind of unpack this, being in the present moment, listening and asking insightful questions is how you show someone you care. And caring is an important fundamental of being a leader. So how can we practice the skill of being more present and of actively listening? That I would equate listening to the footwork example that we used with Kobe. You know, footwork is to basketball as listening is to leadership. So there's one right there that we should all, who are aiming to be more influential and more impactful, we should all be practicing the skill of actively listening. Something I can see that you've already mastered.
It is one of those skills that I'm known for. I try to solicit feedback whenever I can. And people are like, why? You want to know where you mess up? I'm like, absolutely, I want to know where I'm messing up. If it's unseen by me, if I don't realize that I'm doing something that's super annoying, rude, whatever the thing is, and I just haven't learned yet, you know, time passing does not mean I've learned a lesson. By age 12, not everyone has mastered pick the quality. And I solicit feedback because I want to know, like, if I am messing up, am I the type of leader that can be approached and told that I'm messing up? Have I created that culture around me that allows me to do that? And when I get that feedback, that's maybe not as fresh and nice as I would like, how do I respond with that? And like, you know, I remember a time when I was younger, like most men, I would say that you run your mouth, you're a hothead, you're kind of arrogant and cocky and walk around and you think you're hot stuff. And I remember getting feedback that I wasn't okay with. I got upset and I probably said some things that I probably shouldn't have. And upon a little bit of reflection, I went back and I was like, you know what? You're absolutely right. I was completely wrong in the situation. And this person was kind of shocked because apparently the people that I was around that saw who I was, they didn't know that I had that ability within me because I hadn't been showcasing that to them. And when we, you know, look at how we're coming off as a person or really the basics of how we communicate, I always think back to a few years ago, I was an aviation safety officer and I teach aviation safety. And at the time, my daughter was interested in sign language. And you're like, Travis, get to the point. What are you getting with all this stuff here? Well, one of the things that deaf people taught us when we did the sign language classes they were confused by is that we hear music all the time, but we're not dancing all the time. They don't understand how we're just not dancing. And the other thing is they didn't understand how we could communicate without looking at each other. And I'm going to do this for Alan here. I've got my phone up and I'm talking to him. Uh-huh. Yeah. I'm looking at my phone and I'm nodding. If we take Alan's example of attention as the currency of importance and active listening and caring, then that casual communication means that I'm not caring about the other person and they're actively in a situation where I'm showing them that I don't care about them. So what does this look like in an office? It might mean that you put your hands off your keyboard, you look away from your screen, whether that's your laptop or your monitor, and you square up and you look fully at them and you give them their attention that they deserve, that they've earned. That means so much more to them than giving someone a cash bonus or, you know, Amazon gift card for $20. Like that's nice, but that fades quickly. Bring in pizza for the office, that's okay. But being where your feet are, that's caring. That is showing someone that you care. I wanted to mention some things because you talked for quite a bit, just dropping knowledge on us, you know, being preparing for that moment that may or may not come. You know, you look back at the great Tom Brady. And when Drew Bledsoe went down, and if he wasn't prepared to step into that role when the coach called his number, we wouldn't be talking about Tom Brady yet again. This is Monday, January 18th. We're recording this, and Tom Brady just beat Drew Brees to head to the NFC Championship game. Tom Brady's 43. Like, he's been crushing it for 20 years. But the amount of work that he does is just phenomenal. And then you mentioned talking about the leader that you want to be. when you're in the military, when you're growing up, one of the best things someone can tell you is like, look, you're going to have good leaders and you're going to have bad leaders. What can you take from every person that, you know what, I like the way they did that. I'm definitely going to incorporate that into my leadership style. Or, man, that was awful. I am definitely not going to incorporate that into my leadership style. And over time, you end up building all these different attributes or things that you definitely will do or definitely won't do, and define who you are as a leader.
You know, on that point, yeah, there's so much richness there. And if we use Tom Brady as an example, you know, just or any football player for that matter in the NFL, the vast majority of their work takes place during those unseen hours. I mean, in theory, the only seen hours are the 2 to 3 hours that we see them on a Sunday night or a Monday night. Everything else is in preparation. And, you know, when you hear of somebody like a Tom Brady, you know, getting to the facility super early and doing some strength training and some conditioning and then doing a film study and then, you know, actually going through practice and then studying more film afterwards and then having a meeting with his receivers. I mean, you're talking about 8-9 hours every day of that week just to lead up to a 2 to 3 hour game on Sunday. So yeah, there's so much there to unpack. And another thought when it comes to leadership, I do believe that each leader should have a philosophy, you know, a life philosophy, a leadership philosophy, and you should have some core principles and values and pillars that don't change. They are your convictions. Now, two things with that. One, I think we should all be open-minded to being flexible and being able to adapt. You know, 10 years ago, at that time, I was the best leader that I could be at that time. But I'm not the same leader today that I was 10 years ago. And that's because I've learned new information. I've learned new ways of doing things. I've tweaked. So even if you have some incredibly tightly held beliefs, I still think we should be open to learning other ways. And I also think that we should be authentic enough to be chameleon-like in our leadership style, that while your major pillars don't change, if you're leading 40 people in your nonprofit organization, I don't think you should lead each and every individual the exact same way. Now, the overarching foundation should most likely include the same principles. And these are more nuances, particularly from a communication standpoint. But if I'm leading 40 people in the nonprofit space, it's a pretty safe bet that all 40 people don't have the exact same strengths and weaknesses. All 40 people don't have the same needs. You know, if you're on my team, you may require more of my time and attention than one of your teammates, which means I should be willing to devote more time and attention to you because that's what you need when maybe one of your teammates doesn't. You know, and I think being chameleon-like enough that you don't lead everyone the exact same way, and you don't lead the exact same way in every scenario when it comes to these nuances is really, really important. You know, this mindset of, you know, I'm going to do things the same way all of the time with everyone is just simply too rigid.
Yeah, what we're really talking about is the difference between equality, that would be doing something the same each and every time. And we're not talking about just the bare basics of treating another human being with dignity and respect. But we're talking about old school military when people didn't talk to each other. They just screamed orders at each other and they went and did. And the military, thank God, has evolved beyond that because it's not needed. Most people in the military are there for a purpose and a mission and a cause and a, you know, whatever their thing is. And they're going to get going and doing. Sometimes you need a little bit more why. Sometimes you need a little bit more direction. But they're there to do what you need them to do.
I mean, think about the example you just referenced with Tom Brady and the Buccaneers. I mean, Tom Brady has been playing professional football now for 2 decades. I think it's a pretty safe bet that his needs from the head coach or a position coach would be different than someone who's a rookie or a first-year player. Like they, you know, Tom knows the ropes pretty well by now. So the head coach of the Buccaneers will have a different relationship and a different communication style with Tom Brady than maybe he would with a rookie defensive back or someone else. And that part's okay. And I love that you hit that the foundational pillars, being respectful, building trust, caring, those things are going to be the same regardless. I mean, that is the foundation of you as a leader. But now let's make sure that the nuances, you know, we can tweak and we can customize and personalize for every single person on the team. And if anyone listening, if your nonprofit is really scaled and you're a large organization, I don't expect the leader to have a personal relationship with all 642 members of the team. But can you create a system where you've got managers or directors or supervisors that report to you, and you have that relationship with them, and then they have that relationship with their direct reports? So now we've still kind of created this web, if you will, of everyone feeling that they have a leader that they can go to, that they've built trust and respect with, that that person will communicate to them in a style that they prefer. You know, that's the other thing about leadership. We have to remember, it's not about me. It's about you. I mean, I even said that one of my hesitations to coming on the show was I wasn't sure that what I had was going to be of value to the other, to your audience. And that's all that matters to me. The only thing that matters to me right now is that I'm adding value to your life personally, because you're investing your time with me, and that collectively we are adding value to your listeners because they are investing their time with us. And we've already said that time is the most valuable currency. So I want to make sure they feel like it was a wise investment. Of course, I can go on any podcast and talk about what I want to talk about. That's easy. Just turn the mics on. I'm never short for words, but I only want to go on shows where I'm confident that I have something to add value to the other person, because it's not about me. It's about you. And I think that's the leadership mantra 101. Every single morning when you wake up, you make sure you show up. And in today's day and age, showing up might mean showing up virtually. You show up with a mindset of, it's not about me, it's about you. I care about you. I care about your goals. I care about your dreams. I care about your development. I care about your happiness. And if we can lead with that type of mindset, we'll get more buy-in and believe in, and we'll become incredibly magnetic and attractive leaders. People will want to be on our teams because of how much we care about them.
I tell you what, you've dropped ridiculous knowledge in your book. And so far today on this thing, I wanted to bring up Tom Brady being on the Buccaneers. You mentioned that he has coaches. Think about this. Arguably the best player in the game right now, who's been doing it for more than 20 years, who is 43 and quote unquote past his expiration date as a pro football player, still has coaches. He still has people sitting down with him, tweaking the game, holding him accountable. I don't know what kind of person Tom is. I haven't met him, just parked his car a couple of times, but I had a friend that did that. But something tells me that he is willing to take on that feedback, regardless if he's the best at the game or not. He's willing to be held accountable. Hey, Tom, remember that hissy fit after the second down pass when you missed? What the F? And he's going to be like, you know what? You're right. That's not who I am. That's not what my did. I let my mindset get away from me a little bit, and now I'm more focused. That is the kind of leader / worker that you want, because at any time, I'm going to be wanted personally. I mentioned this already. I want to be called on my stuff, because something is going to go on. I'm going to get distracted. I'm going to get frustrated. Something's going to happen where I'm not quote unquote on my game. And if you don't hold me accountable, I know that I've just lost you as a leader, as a worker, as a fellow man, if I can't be held accountable. If you're not willing to come to me, then do I have friends? Am I really a leader? Am I just some guy that screams from the desk?
With that, you bring up another great point, and I'm loving the way this is kind of volleying back and forth in the direction we're headed, but it's so important for everyone listening to this to understand and to make this understood in your organization, that holding someone accountable is something you do for them. It's not something you do to them. I think lots of times people get that confused, especially a lot of young people. You know, when I ask a lot of young people, including my own children, what do they think of when they hear the word discipline? You know, the connotation, and every word has an emotional connotation. We feel something sometimes viscerally about a certain word. And many young people and people in general, they think of discipline is almost a negative connotation. It's punishment. You need to be disciplined when you do something wrong. And yet I believe discipline is the key to freedom. Discipline is the key to high performance. Discipline is the key to happiness, to fulfillment, to success. I mean, you fill in the blank. I remember a coach told me when I was really young, you know, Alan, if you discipline yourself, then others won't have to. And that really resonated with me. It was you know what? I'm going to try to do what's right at all times, whether someone's watching or not. And if I do that, chances are I won't get in a whole lot of trouble if I'm always making a sincere attempt to do what's right. So on an, from an accountability standpoint, one of the most important things that needs to resonate in every organization is that accountability from teammate to teammate or from coach to player or from manager to employee, accountability is a gift. It's one of the best gifts you can give someone. Because if I'm holding you accountable, I'm basically telling you, look, I believe in you. I trust you. I know you're so competent and so capable that I'm not going to let you slide with your level of effort right now, or I'm not going to let you slide with that poor attitude that you had yesterday. I'm going to hold you to such a high standard of excellence because I care about you and because I believe in you. And when you can create, and you said it perfectly before, a safe environment where people feel compelled and almost to some degree obligated to offer sincere and open feedback and to hold each other accountable, then you've got something really, really special. And the reason this is important, you know, I understand as human beings, we have kind of this default self-preservation mechanism that when somebody offers us some feedback, we can interpret that as almost being a personal attack. And we need to protect ourselves. And we protect ourselves by deflecting it or by making an excuse or by blaming someone else or just good old-fashioned complaining. When in theory, we should take a step back and say, you know what? My goodness, I should be so thankful that Travis cares enough to give me this feedback, that he cares enough about me to tell me something that may be a blind spot that I'm not aware of. So if I can take a breath and realize this is not a personal attack, this is feedback that has one goal, which is to make me better, I should be incredibly grateful that someone cares enough to offer that type of feedback. But it takes a while to work to that because our human default is to deflect and is to blame and make excuses and complain. And there's no shortage of those things in today's world, but we have to learn how to get past that. You know, a high performer like Tom Brady doesn't just want feedback, he craves feedback because he knows feedback is the only gateway to him continuing to improve. And for a guy like Tom Brady, that's the only goal. Is improvement because he knows he's at a level that if he performs at the level he's capable of, winning just takes care of itself. You know, Super Bowls are the result of doing things right consistently, being open to feedback, and all of the other things that we've talked about. So high performers understand feedback and accountability are a gift, and they should be welcomed and they should be given and received openly and with tremendous appreciation.
If you're listening to this and right now you're like, well, that's no problem at all, Alan and Travis. I give people all the accountability they can handle. If it's not being received well, maybe you need to do the gracious thing and tweak the way your approach is to make sure they're not immediately defensive when you approach and be like, you know, hey, Alan, I know you're doing great things, but if I could just offer one little slight tweak to what you're already doing, that's amazing. I can't really see your book cover behind your head, and I would love this to be a nonstop ad for your book because I want you to be successful in life. And if you actually just tweaked, you know, your photo arrangement in the background, we could really see what it is you're about. You know, something like that. Alan doesn't feel attacked, I hope. You know, it may or may not be real feedback, but you can tweak your approach to make sure that you know that they care about you. We call it kind of the military, well, I won't use the term we call in the military, but it's kind of a feedback sandwich. You say that you think they're doing good stuff. You tell them what the feedback is. And at the end of it, you let them know that you still care about them.
Absolutely. And what I was going to say is, and this is the analogy that I use, and it's somewhat archaic and it's a little generalized, but hope folks find it helpful. So funny enough, at the time of this recording, in 2 days on the 20th, I'll turn 45 years old. So putting me in that age bracket, when I was a child, we didn't have all of the different medicines and flavors and delivery models that we have today. When I was a kid, you could basically put every kid in the world in one of two buckets. You had kids that can swallow a Tylenol pill, and you had kids that had to have it smashed up and put in applesauce to take the Tylenol pill. Those are the only two options. And in full transparency, I was one of the applesauce kids to a an embarrassingly old age. But here's the reason I bring that up. I want every leader listening to this right now, I want you to think about that analogy when you're going to give feedback to someone on your team. And just quickly ask yourself, can this person take the Tylenol straight? Or do they need it smashed up with a little bit of applesauce? You know, do they need it softened and sweetened a little bit? Or can I give it to them direct? In both instances, I'm going to be honest. In both instances, I'm going to be thoughtful. In both instances, I'm going to have empathy. But in the first, if I've established that this person I can communicate with directly, then that's how I'm going to give them their feedback. Whereas if I've established that someone needs it softened a little bit, then that's how I'm going to deliver it. And the key to this is, as the leader, it does not matter how you prefer to take your Tylenol. All that matters is how they prefer to take it. And that's where I think we've seen a shift, certainly in sport, in my experience, but I would love to hear your experience in the military. You know, when I was growing up, the head coach would say, everyone's taking the Tylenol this way. And if you don't like it, then don't play on this team. And I don't believe that's the most effective way to lead. I think we should care enough about our players to say how they prefer to take it is important to me. And like I said, this doesn't mean that we're skirting honesty or the truth. It just simply means we want to customize every communication as much as possible. So anytime I'm going to offer feedback to someone, whether it's my children or a colleague, I go back to my thoughts and say, okay, can this person take it straight or do they need it with some applesauce? And then I deliver it in the way that they prefer. And when you do that, you will reduce the chance that they're going to deflect or blame or complain or make an excuse. It doesn't mean that they'll never do that. We are human beings, and we also have to go into it knowing that, hey, I'm going to give Travis some feedback because he is a human being, and because this is some really tough feedback, there's a good chance he's going to make an excuse or blame someone. So my job as a leader is, can I get you to go through that process quicker than you would on your own? Can I get you to kind of get your feelings out quicker than letting this be something that draws on? And I think if we're very customized and intentional in how we approach and deliver feedback, then that will be the case.
If you're listening to this right now as you're driving to work or wherever you happen to be, you haven't seen that I've been laughing with Alan here the whole time, because as soon as he is telling out an analogy, it's just fantastic. I'm thinking back. I got transported back in time. I've got a time machine, and I am a young E5 in the Navy, and I'm picturing one of the guys that I'm trying to work with, and his quote is, I am not a doctor. I'm not the candy man. I'm not here to sugarcoat shit. And I'm just laughing because I'm picturing this whole scenario unfold as he's talking about the Tylenol. And I'm like, great, you made your point. They got it. Yeah. How'd they receive that? Did they take on board what you said, or they completely knock it out of their way and out of their life, and they had their shields up their whole time? Like, what do you mean? I'm like, in the military, we call it firing for effect. It's not just the fact that you launch a missile. Did the missile do what it was intended to do? And if you're taking the time to provide someone this valuable feedback, and I love the applesauce analogy, did it land the way it needed to land? Was your goal of providing the feedback that is so valuable actually take effect? Or did they completely ignore it? I picture something I've used with family in the past. You know, you're in a grocery store and you're just trying to get your stuff done, and there's a young woman in there, and she's got four kids, and the kids are all over and they're screaming and they're just being unruly. You have some options. You could say, oh, can't you handle your kids? What's the matter with you? You could say that. Or you could say, you know, I remember when I had a young family and just how hard it is to do something as simple as grocery shopping. Hey, keep your head up. You might have reminded her to kind of corral her kids a little bit, but one was smothered in applesauce and really easy to take down.
Yes. And you know, one other thought, and this is why I also believe, especially, I think we should lead with this in every area of our life, but especially when we're going to be giving feedback, when it's constructive feedback, is we should always lead with empathy and compassion. And we also have to acknowledge that in any given situation, we only know some of the information. We rarely know the entire story. A perfect example with that young lady in the grocery store. You have no idea what preceded you seeing her and them misbehaving. You have no idea what went on earlier that day or what went on, you know, the day before. I know it's a little bit cliche and I don't know who came up with the original story, but there was something similar to that. And this guy was really frustrated that this person's kids were so unruly until he found out they were on their way home from their mother's funeral. And that this father, you know, here he is trying to be in control of his children, but they just buried their mother. So can we give them a little bit of slack and a little bit of leniency that maybe they're not in an emotional state to be the most well-behaved? And if we just go into it with an assumption, this person's a bad parent, they can't even keep their four kids in line, then we're going to really miss out an opportunity to connect, an opportunity to offer some valuable feedback. And that's why leading with empathy and compassion. So in any situation, if I'm going to give you feedback on something, I need to go into it knowing I don't know all of the details. All I know is what I'm privy to and what I've seen. And it's okay for me to acknowledge that. And I think anytime we can have the humility and the empathy and compassion to acknowledge that we don't know the full picture. So this is also an opportunity of, you know, hey, Travis, I'm going to give you some feedback just based on what I can see. If I'm missing any major details or my feedback isn't as accurate because of some misinformation, this is a two-way street. This is not you stand there and take it from me. This is I'd like to have a discussion because the proposal you turned in yesterday was not satisfactory. I don't believe it was your best work. And I'm a little disappointed with what you turned in. But I also realize that I don't have all of the information and I'd like to discuss this with you. I have so much belief in you. You know, you are a high performer, but for whatever reason, and maybe it's because I wasn't clear in my expectations, but for whatever reason, the proposal you turned in yesterday was less than satisfactory. And I'd love to be able to have a discussion about it. And if all I start hearing from you is blaming, complaining, and making excuses, then I can go in one direction. If you let me know, hey, you know, there's some information, Alan, that you're not quite privy to that's part of the reason that this wasn't done as well as possible. Now it's more of a discussion. It's not this one-way street. And I think as leaders, that's incredibly important. And on the topic of expectations and children for that matter, I've got three kids. I have 10-year-old twin sons and an 8-year-old daughter. And the other night after dinner, I asked my 10-year-old son, Luke, to clean the table. So Luke grabbed the dishes and the utensils and the glasses. He threw them in the sink and he sprinted off to his room to fire up his iPad. And I was a little bit frustrated because that's not how I define cleaning the table. You know, I believe cleaning the table means you take the dishes and the utensils and the glasses, you rinse them out, you scrub them out, you line them up neatly in the dishwasher, you take a Clorox rag and you wipe the table off. And if you knocked any crumbs on the ground, you either sweep them up or vacuum them up. That's how I define cleaning the table. But right when I was about to scold him because I was a little frustrated, I started to chuckle because I realized the failure was on me as the leader. I did not give clear expectations of what I meant when I said clean the table. I left it up to him to interpret. And I think most people can agree that he interpreted it in a way that most 10-year-olds would interpret it.
Yeah. Do the it's clean, Dad. What's the problem? I got absolutely games to play.
So I brought him back out and I said, hey, buddy, this was not your fault. This was my fault. I didn't tell you what I meant by clean the table and I didn't define it with great clarity. So now I'm going to do that. Let me explain when I say clean the table. This is what I mean. And he said, sure, Dad, no problem. I can do that. And we nipped it in the bud, but only because I was willing to acknowledge that it was my fault, not his, that I did not give him expectations. So many times when we have to give feedback to someone, it's important that we also take into account what role have we played in wherever they've come up short or whatever we need them to do differently. Have you given great clarity on expectations and standards of excellence? And that's why as leaders and as communicators, it always needs to be looked at as a two-way street. You know, using that example, if I was bringing you in and telling you that the proposal you submitted was less than ideal, you know, I need to ask myself, did I articulate exactly what I expected from you? Did I provide you the resources and the support that you would have needed to do it at the level that I asked? or did I just throw you to the wolves? So these are questions I have to ask myself. So, you know, before I'm going to give feedback to anyone, I'm going to ask myself, what role have I played in this? What could I have done differently? And then I want to, with great humility and vulnerability, acknowledge that when we have our chat.
Absolutely. I love that you paused for a moment to give your son some feedback and you had to corral yourself in. You really have to control the controllables. You've only got a couple things within our ability that we fully have capacity to do. Like if I'm overweight, if I've chosen to eat more than I should and not work out as much as I should, I have decided that I'm going to weigh more tomorrow than I do today. If I have a situation and someone slaps me in the face, I can choose how to respond. Is it immediately going to be a slap back? Am I going to scream? Am I going to cry? Am I going to run away? Am I going to grab a weapon? Like, I haven't then chosen how I'm going to respond to that situation. I know you touched about this a little bit on your book. What do you have that you have control over?
I believe that only two things we have 100% control over 100% of the time is our own effort and our own attitude. And certainly attitude is fairly all encompassing. You know, I do believe that if you mix up some effort and some attitude, you have preparation. Like, we control our preparation. If you have some effort and some attitude and you mix them up, you control your enthusiasm. I mean, you absolutely control how much enthusiasm you bring to anything that you do. But for simplicity's sake, it's really only those two. Now, with a few thoughts on that. One, the late Jim Valvano, who was the coach of the NC State Wolfpack basketball program, one of my all-time favorite professional speakers. He was phenomenal. Basically said that, well, if working hard is a choice, then not working hard is also a choice. You know, it's binary. There has to be another side to that coin. So anytime someone gives you less than their best effort, it is a choice. Now, it might be an unconscious choice, but it's still a choice. Now, we don't always feel our best. We're not always at 100. So I'm not implying that someone can give 100% all of the time, but you can give 100% of what you have to give all of the time. You know, if you're mentally and physically exhausted and you haven't been feeling well and you've been dealing with some adversity and you're having some mental health issues, you might show up with only 60% of in your tank, but you and you alone choose whether you're going to give 100% of that 60%. Are you going to give the best effort you're capable of? So effort is always a choice. And I don't believe there's ever a viable excuse for not giving your best effort. There are certainly reasons, and there are reasons that we can all have an appreciation and empathy and understanding for. But at the end of the day, effort is a choice, and we should all make an effort to give our best effort as consistently as possible. And then when it comes to attitude, the way I look at attitude is how you just teed it up so perfectly. It's more about how you respond to situations. You do not choose for someone to slap you in the face. But once that has now become fact, you absolutely choose how you respond to that. And if you want to be a high performer, you will consistently choose a response that moves you forward and improves your situation. You will choose responses that are in alignment with your core beliefs and your values and your purpose. And that's what's most important. We do not control the vast majority of things that go on in this world, but we control how we respond to them. And yes, sometimes there's not many options in how one responds. Sometimes the things that happen to us and around us are incredibly adverse and catastrophic. So I'm not implying that any of this is easy to do. You know, when we talk about the things that happen to us, if we're talking about death or being furloughed or going bankrupt or a sickness or something happens to your child, I'm not for one second implying that choosing a positive response to those things is easy, because it's not. But it is still your choice, and you have to own that. And, you know, what normally happens is people have created patterns of default that when something happens to them, they just have this knee-jerk reaction, an emotional response. And many times it's not really in alignment with what will move them forward, you know, or improve their situation. So having the ability to have the self-awareness to, you know, regulate our emotions and to choose things that are favorable is really important. With that said, I had the mental conditioning coach of the San Francisco Giants once told me that our emotions are designed to inform us, not designed to direct us. And this is why this is so important as a leader. As leaders, there is nothing wrong with you getting angry, upset, feeling frustrated, disappointed, sad, jealous. I mean, you insert the emotion. There's nothing wrong with feeling those emotions. However, you cannot let them dictate the way you lead or dictate the way you treat someone or dictate the way you communicate. So if you're angry at someone, there's nothing wrong with that. If you demean that person or treat them poorly or lash out at them because you're angry, now we have a problem. And that really lessens your ability as a leader. So using that example we've already talked about, you and I are colleagues. You turn in a less than ideal proposal, something, you know, well below what I was expecting, and I'm really frustrated and I'm really disappointed. It's okay for me to feel those things. It's not okay for me to treat you poorly because of it. And as leaders, we have to know that our emotions are going to ebb and flow, moment by moment, day by day. But our leadership and our ability to pour into others can't also ebb and flow. That needs to be incredibly consistent. So we've got all of this stuff going on in the world that we have no control over. But as long as I can control my effort and my response to those things, then my leadership will be consistent. And that's really important. You know, I think one of the worst traits of a leader would be if you're thinking and you're talking to some of your teammates and you're like, I wonder which Alan is going to show up today. You know, I have to tell Alan something, but only if he's in a good mood. You know, if he's not in a good mood, then I can't approach him. To me, that would show a glaring, you know, weakness as a leader that my own team doesn't view me, that I can be consistent and that I can regulate my emotions.
I tell you what, you've been dropping knowledge here for a good 50 minutes by my watch. And I like to wrap up normally saying things about the difference between knowledge and action. And I've definitely ripped off G.I. Joe multiple times on my show. Like, you know, knowing is only half the battle and the other half is action. And I was reading through your book and I was like, oh, what do you know? Something in here about knowledge. Do you got this quote on hand? Do you know what quote I'm going to bring up?
Well, I mean, it's going to be something to the effect of, you know, there's going to be a difference between knowing and doing, and that knowledge without action is utterly useless. And, you know, yeah, I mean, I'm glad you ripped off G.I. Joe. What an incredibly insightful and wise leader he was, because knowing is only half the battle. And it's funny because in reference to my book, I say that all the time, and I say it kind of for a chuckle and some dramatic effect. But I tell people, you know, reading my book will do nothing for you. And they kind of look at me. Reading my book and applying those principles can absolutely change your life. But just reading the book and not making any change is not going to do anything for you. In fact, you might as well not read it if you're not going to apply what it is that you read. So when I get to say the part two of it, they usually laugh and connect the dots and understand what I meant. But it's so true. You know, two quotes come to mind. One is, if nothing changes, nothing changes. Like, you have to be willing to make a change in order to get a change. And one that we should all look in the mirror and say every day of our lives is, you know, if you keep doing what you've been doing, you will keep getting what you've been getting. If you don't like what you've been getting, you need to change what you've been doing. I mean, it's simplicity 101, but not easy to do.
Oh, absolutely. Just so I can get my nervous tick and take care of this thing, the quote that I got from the book was, knowledge by itself is useless. The power is in the application. It is so true. And when I talk to my military buddies, I'm like, knowing is only half the battle. And they're like, oh yeah. And I'm like, the other half is violence, is putting together that the action that you've been training for and studying for and working hard for into action. It doesn't matter if you know how to solve world hunger if you never tell anybody about it or take the action to make it happen. It doesn't matter that you know the right things to do with nutrition and exercise if you never eat right and work out. It doesn't matter if you know you're supposed to call your mom on Mother's Day if you don't call your mom on Mother's Day. It doesn't matter what you know. It matters what you do.
Well, what's interesting about that is, I mean, we live at the height of the information age. You know, lack of knowledge is hardly ever the problem anymore. Maybe 70, 80 years ago, it could have been. But now lack of knowledge is not the problem, because if there's anything you don't know, we're all tethered to a device that can tell us what we need to know in just a matter of seconds. So let's even use, you know, you brought up a couple of times, kind of a fitness, like workout, being healthy from a physical standpoint mindset. I'm willing to bet that if I pulled every one of the listeners right now that are listening to this show, and I asked them to come up with a list of the healthiest foods that they know of, they could come up with a pretty robust list. If I asked every one of your listeners, how much sleep are you supposed to get every single night? They would all shout out a number in a split second, and most of them would actually shout out the exact same number. And if I asked every one of your listeners and said, can you just kind of etch out in some notes what a weekly workout routine should look like? You don't have to submit it to Men's or Women's Health, but just generally speaking, how many times a week should you work out? How long for each session? And what are some of the things you should do? Every single one of your listeners would be able to etch that out. But then if I actually held them to the fire and I asked each and every one of your listeners individually, are these the foods that you eat? It's yes or no. It's a binary question. Is this the amount of sleep you got last night? Once again, it's a yes or a no. And are these the type of workouts that you do regularly? Yes or no. You would start to see who has a performance gap. And a performance gap is the gap between what we know and what we do. And in this instance, as you've said brilliantly, if someone is not as physically fit as they like, it's not because they don't have the knowledge. It's because they haven't been acting on that knowledge. You know, yes, there's different degrees of knowledge for sure. But as far as just being physically fit, everyone has the baseline knowledge that they need. Eat healthy foods in appropriate portions, you know, get plenty of rest, hydrate, and move your body most days of the week. If people do those things consistently, then they usually have an adequate level of fitness. Now, if they need to heighten that fitness because they're training for something specific or they really want to look a certain way, then yeah, they might have to be a little bit more disciplined. But just generally speaking, that's all you need to do. Eat healthy foods in appropriate portions, get plenty of sleep, and move your body. And yet statistically, most people in our country don't do those three things. And it's not because they don't know. It's because they don't do. And anyone listening to this right now, if I'm talking to you, I'm not saying that to make you feel bad. And I'm not saying it to call you out. I'm just saying it to make sure you understand you already have the knowledge required to get what you want to get. Now you have to do the hard part, which is actually, you know, putting it into action.
I don't understand why I don't have any money. Well, it's because you spend it all and don't save. It's the super basic stuff. It's the Dave Ramsey. He doesn't give you great financial advice. He gives you advice your grandma would tell you, that you should save for a rainy day, that you should take care of your responsibilities, aka your bills. You shouldn't accumulate new ones that don't help you reach your mission, vision, and goals. It's not world groundbreaking stuff, but the reason people like Alan and Dave Ramsey and maybe even me are so successful is because we understand that there is that performance gap, that people don't understand the basics. And yeah, you might occasionally bump into someone that's a pro at what they do, and they're like, why are you bringing up this stuff? Because the vast majority of people either don't know it, or they do know it, but they aren't doing it. And that's why we're able to keep booking gigs and getting on podcasts and selling books and talking about the things that we're bringing up, because the performance gap, people just aren't doing what they need to do when they need to do it. Alan, share with us what you have on the horizon. What's coming up for you in your world?
Well, at present, you know, with the world still being somewhat shut down, most of my way of being of service to others, whether they're businesses, sports teams, or folks in the nonprofit, are through virtual engagements and giving virtual keynotes and leading virtual workshops and webinars and so forth. So as much as I love being in front of people and being on an actual stage with a live in-person audience, I'm really starting to develop an affinity for doing things virtually, because it's what we have to do at the moment. I do look forward to that changing and being able to at least have some small groups, you know, being able to get together in person. So a good portion of my time is spent delivering for clients virtually, as well as I am working on a second book now, a follow-up to Raise Your Game. It will be called Sustain Your Game, and it'll be about how to manage stress, alleviate stagnation, and beat burnout. So it's once you've raised your game to high performance, how can you keep it there for long periods of time and still really enjoy your work. So I'm having fun writing that. And other than that, just trying to make the most with what I have, where I am. And this is a perfect example. This pandemic is not ideal for anyone. I think everyone wishes they could snap their fingers and it would just disappear, but it's not going to, not at that rate. So what we need to do is figure out and have an attitude of what's the best response possible to the challenges, the adversities, and the limitations I'm feeling. And that's what's most important. And I guess it's kind of a final thought to put a big bow tie on everything we've talked about, but especially the end of this conversation. What I find is being really helpful is I've got great clarity of the man that I want to become. As I mentioned, in a couple of days from this recording, I'll turn 45. And I've got great clarity of the man I want to be 20 years from now. Now, I am well aware that time is not promised. There is absolutely no guarantee that I'll live to see the age of 65, but I am very intentional about taking care of myself, so I don't see any reason why I won't live that long. But I have great clarity of the man I want to be 20 years from now. And without getting too granular, I want the 65-year-old Alan to be physically, mentally, and emotionally fit. I want the 65-year-old Alan to have a very deep connection with his children and his family and his friends. I want the 65-year-old Alan, similar to everyone listening to this right now, doing meaningful work that serves other people. That's who I want to be 20 years from now. So right now in the present, my goal is to make as many decisions as possible in alignment with becoming that person. From what I choose to eat for breakfast, to who I follow on Instagram, to what I watch on Netflix, I want it to be in alignment with becoming the person that I aim to be. And I'm not aiming for perfection, which is good news because I'm far from perfect, but I do aim for progress. And I know that if most of the decisions I make every day, large or small, are in alignment with becoming that person, then if I do live another 20 years on this planet, that is the man that I will become. And I don't want anyone to be surprised by that or shocked by that, because I'm telling you now, that is who I'll be, because I'm designing my future in the present moment by making these good decisions. And the question I ask myself every night before I go to bed, basically say, you know, I just traded 24 hours of my life for the progress I made today. Am I happy with that trade? You know, I just gave up my most valuable currency, my time, for whatever progress I made today. Am I cool with that? And if I can say, yes, that was a pretty good trade for today, then I can close my eyes and have some pretty restful sleep. And on the rare occasion where I say, you know what, today was not my best day. I did not make great decisions, made a few missteps. That's okay, because today is always over tomorrow. And I just wake up the next day and say, all right, yesterday was not my best day, but today I'm going to do a little bit better. And as long as my arrow is going up and my arrow is pointed in the direction that I'm trying to go, that's what's most important to me. So anyone listening to this, I don't want you to worry about where you are right now at this moment. I want you to be much more concerned with the direction at which your arrow is headed, and let's make sure it's headed up. And even if it's headed up at a very small, gradual incline, there's nothing wrong with that. Don't be in any hurry. Just make sure that that arrow is pointed up. And if we can do that, then I really and truly believe we'll be working towards not only success, which is what everyone talks about, but happiness and fulfillment as well. And, you know, especially to those in the nonprofit world, as I said at the beginning, I have so much respect and admiration for the altruism of what you all are doing and the altruism of each of your individual mission statements and purposes. You're really working towards making a great life, not only for yourself, but for others.
Wow. I am impressed. I knew I would be impressed, but I wanted you to know, I wanted you to give the honor of the feedback to let you know.
Thank you.
That I'm impressed. Alan, where can we get a hold of you? Where can we find you? Where can we connect with you? How can we get your amazing stuff that you have?
Well, my main hub is at alansteinjr.com. And there's a ton of information on there about speaking and so forth. If you go to alansteinjr.com/free, F-R-E-E, there's a ton of free downloadable videos and PDFs that you're certainly welcome to share liberally with everyone in your organization. I also have a brand new site that just launched called StrongerTeam.com that's filled with resources for anyone that's trying to improve organizational performance. If you do have an interest in the book, you know, if you just need a single copy for yourself, you can search for Raise Your Game on Amazon or Audible if you prefer to listen. If you'd like to get a team set for your entire organization, I can offer a really generous discount on a bulk order, and I can even sign every single copy. Just email me, alan@alansignjr.com. And then lastly, I try to be very accessible on social media. So I'm at Alan Stein Jr. on Instagram and Twitter and LinkedIn, and love engaging with folks there. So anyone that was listening, you know, if you'd like to have some conversation or continue the discussion or give me some feedback, by all means, just shoot me a DM on social and I'd love to engage.
And just like Alan, I love that feedback. It raises my personal morale when someone gives me that like, rate, review, share, all that good stuff. Because at the end of the day, look, it's not about me. It's about me. I need that ego boost. I'm just kidding. Alan, thank you so much for being on the show today. Loved having you on.
Thank you so much.
Been listening to The Nonprofit Architect. To listen to all our past shows, visit http://nonprofitarchitect.org. And be sure to subscribe, rate, and review our show. Thank you.